Good evening, everyone. Good evening. If you'd open up your Bibles, please, to Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews, the fourth chapter. I'm going to read one verse there in just a moment that will set up the thoughts of our study this evening. Hebrews chapter 4, that will really just be the beginning of several different passages that we will read and consider tonight over the course of these next several minutes. And so you will certainly be benefited by following along in the scriptures and checking the things that I have to say in light of the Word of God. I don't want anybody to just take my word for anything. In fact, if you have a disagreement with something that I say tonight or at all this week, you feel free to come to me and bring those things up, ask a question, or just correct me if need be. I want to be moldable and pliable to recognize if maybe I've missed it in some way, and maybe you can help me to see it a little bit better. It is great to see everybody tonight. So glad that you are here. Just a great number. Lots of folks from the community, folks from other congregations in the area, the folks that are regular members here. Thank you all for being here tonight as we come together to give God worship and to think a little bit about the things that He's given to us in His Word. We're talking this week about the help that comes from God. And while God is able to deliver the help that we need in all kinds of different channels and means, we're looking specifically at the help that He provides us through His Word, the guidance, the instruction, the wisdom and the counsel that He offers us for all of life's challenges and difficulties. And in a lot of ways, this lesson tonight really was almost kind of the impetus for the whole week. I really kind of picked this lesson first and framed the whole series around it because this is one that as I've preached this sermon at a couple of other places, I've just found, man, folks just really, really need this in different ways. And I think you'll find that maybe it hits you in different ways throughout the evening. Let's read together in Hebrews chapter 4. Let's set things up there in verse 15, where the writer says this. In Hebrews 4 and in verse 15, speaking about Jesus, he says, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin." I don't know about the rest of you, but riding on an elevator is not my favorite thing in the world to do. And it actually has nothing to do with the motion of the elevator or getting some kind of sick, queasy feeling when the elevator goes up and down and shakes back and forth. That's really not what bothers me about elevator rides. What I find most awkward and most difficult is riding in elevators with other people. Imagine you have to go visit somebody at the hospital, and you're going to need to take the elevator up to the 5th or 6th or 7th floor in order to get to their room. Chances are, in all likelihood, you're probably going to end up taking a ride on that elevator with a stranger, or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5. And I don't know about you, but I just always find that to be very, very awkward and uncomfortable. You know, here I am in this small enclosed box with people that I really did not choose to be with. I don't know them. They don't know me. And now we're going to take this journey. We're going to go up or we're going to go down. And I use the word journey, realizing that, yes, it's only a 30-second trip or a 60-second trip. But we are going to take a trip. We're going to take a trip together. And we might even pick up some additional folks along the way as we're going up or as we're coming down. And that's just weird to me. And it's made all the more difficult when maybe you're in that confined space and here you are, you're rubbing shoulders with a person you've never met before. Or maybe somebody comes on the elevator and they're rocking a little bit of body odor and that makes things awkward for everybody else. Or maybe somebody brings a child on board and a child sees all those buttons and they want to touch all of them at the same time. That makes things really, really difficult. When you're stuck in that environment, there is this feeling that, well, we're all kind of bonded together now, so what are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to say? I know what I do a lot of times during those rides. I study the shoelaces of my shoes very, very carefully, I find. I get very acquainted with the tops of my shoes. It's just a struggle to know how to act and what to say. But we got to figure it out, don't we? Got to figure it out because we've been thrust together, whether we like it or not, and we're going to take this little journey. In many ways, I think that elevator ride is a very apt metaphor for what it's like sometimes in family. Think about it. Families are a group of people that we are stuck with for a relatively short period of time. And sometimes it can be a struggle when we're all cooped up together as a family. Think about it. Generally speaking, You don't get to choose your family. Now, I'm certainly thankful that God chose my mom and my dad, but I didn't get any say in that. God didn't consult me about that. I didn't get to pick my parents and decide who they were, and really kind of in one sense, they didn't even get to pick me. They didn't know what they were getting until September the 1st, 1980. I made my entrance into the world, and I then stepped on their elevator. And now for the last 42 years now, we've had to figure out how to take the elevator ride of life together as a family. I didn't have any choice about my siblings either. I'm thankful for them, but again, God didn't consult me about that. That was kind of just thrust upon me February of 1982. My brother Luke got on the elevator. August of 1984, my brother Aaron, he jumped on the elevator. October of 1985, my brother Ben, he got on the elevator. It's starting to get really, really crowded in here, you see. And for all these years, we've had to try to figure out how to take this ride together. My wife, she didn't get to choose her in-laws. Now, she chose me. She knew what she was getting here. But when she chose to ride the elevator of life with me, she got all the crazy, kooky McKibben clan that just kind of came with the package. And the same thing goes for my in-laws. That goes for aunts and uncles and grandparents and cousins and all the different people who are all packed together, the wacky relatives who are in this elevator as we try to figure out how to cooperate, how to communicate as we do life together. Here's the difference, though, in that elevator ride that happens at the hospital and the family elevator ride. When people get off of the elevator ride at the hospital, there's a real possibility I may never see those people ever again for the rest of my life. But that's not so with family, is it? With family, we hop on the elevator of life together, and that's not just some little 60-second ride, is it? No, it's a long ride. And of course, if we're going to be on a long ride together, we want that ride to be as smooth and as pleasant and as problem-free as it possibly can be. We want our family dynamic to be as harmonious as the Waltons or the Ingalls or the Cleaver family. We want our family gatherings to look like a perfect Norman Rockwell painting where everybody's smiling and everybody's happy and everybody's got unity and harmony, and yet all too often, it doesn't really work out that way. And that is because sometimes we have families that consist of difficult people. We have families that consist of abrasive personalities. We have family members who are poor communicators. We have family members who have very messed up lives. And what happens is they then bring all of that baggage onto the elevator. Now it's really getting crowded in here, and it's making it really hard for us to be together. Maybe it's a dad who keeps hounding you about, when are you going to get a real job and stop fooling around? Maybe it's a mom who keeps comparing you to your sibling, always making you feel as if you can't quite measure up to the standards that they want. Maybe it's an in-law who maybe thinks or maybe even says out loud, why in the world did my child marry you? Stephen walked right into my periphery when I pointed my finger when I said that. That was intentional. I think all of us have experienced that kind of thing to some degree in our families. And let's just be honest about that. That doesn't feel good. It's not enjoyable. It hurts. It makes life just tough. It's one of the more unpleasant things about life on earth. And maybe just to complicate things even further is that pain is often magnified and is the result of family members who are not Christians. Family members who are not following Jesus, trying to live according to His Word. Family members who really don't have any interest in the kinds of things that we're doing this evening. We are spiritually incompatible with them. Maybe we've got a few things in common. We share the same last name and got some other things that maybe we share. But on this and this, man, we couldn't be further apart, could we? We're so different, completely different from them. And since our values and since our priorities and our outlook on life is so different from theirs, that unfortunately is what oftentimes causes the friction. It's what causes the turmoil. Think about it, here in a couple of months, it's fixing to be holiday time. And a lot of people look forward to that, for the opportunity to be with their families. But I know a lot of folks who absolutely dread these upcoming months because they just know what it's going to be. It's going to be fussing and fighting. It's going to be bickering. It's going to be problematic. It's going to be difficult. The question is, what can we do about that? Is there anything that we can do about that? Where could we possibly turn for some guidance and for some help? Well, you know exactly where I'm going to have us turn to. We want to turn to the Lord. In fact, I'm going to suggest to you that we're going to turn to Jesus in these matters. Would you believe me if I told you that Jesus could help us with these kinds of things? In that passage we just read in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15, the writer says there that Jesus can sympathize with just about anything that we experience in this life. He understands the struggles that we face because he was here. He's been here. He's done it. And I'm going to suggest to you that yes, that even includes dealing with difficult family members. It may surprise you to learn that Jesus had difficult family members. In fact, for some people, it may surprise you to learn that Jesus even had a family at all. But he did. He had a mom and a dad. He had brothers and he had sisters. And in many ways, I believe Jesus may have had more conflict and more trouble with his relatives than any of us can even begin to imagine. Which is why this evening I'm going to recommend that the help that we need in this department is for us to just sit with Jesus for a little while. Of all the dysfunctional families in the Bible that we could look at and that we could learn from, I believe we can actually do no better than to look at our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Because if ever you were inclined to say, maybe you've even prayed before, and you've maybe even just said to the Lord, Lord, you just don't have any idea of how hard this is. Lord, you don't have any concept of how difficult it is to try to get along with these people. Lord, you don't know what it's like to be taken for granted or to be misunderstood or maybe even to be just outright have hostility directed toward you by your flesh and blood. You know what Jesus is going to say in response to that? Jesus is going to say, oh, my child, yes, I do. Jesus knows all about it. And he is able to sympathize with your frustrations and your difficulties way more than you would ever know. Someone will maybe be saying right now, Josh, how so? What exactly are you talking about? What in particular did Jesus have to put up with in his family? Well, let's just work a little bit in the Gospels. How about we do that? Let's start with that. Look at me in Luke chapter 2. Let's put some passages together beginning in Luke chapter 2. Let's read some episodes and some scenes in the life of Jesus. In Luke chapter 2, this is Jesus actually at a very young age. This is Jesus at the age of 12. And he is in Jerusalem with his parents to observe the Passover. And as far as I can tell, it seems as if Jesus had the support of his mother Mary and his father Joseph. We don't know everything about that relationship, at least as much as we would like. We know maybe a little bit more about Mary than we do Joseph. But I'm going to say that it seems as if they were mostly supportive of their very special son. And yet, despite all of that, they didn't always understand everything about the specialness of their son. Case in point, right here in Luke chapter 2, read with me if you will in verse 46. In Luke 2 and in verse 46, after 3 days, they found Jesus in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when his parents saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I, we've been searching for you in great distress. And he said to them, Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house? And they, verse 50, they did not understand the saying that he spoke to them. Right here, even at a very early age, I think this is a microscopic picture of something that was probably a much larger issue throughout their lives. And that is that Jesus' family, they just didn't understand him. They didn't always get it about him, the things that he said and the things that he did. The things that he was saying and doing was just kind of outside the scope of their understanding, maybe even seemed a little bit weird to them. Can I ask you, can you relate to that frustration in your own life? Maybe you've tried to do something that was good, tried to do something that was right, and folks, even in your own family, they just totally misunderstood that. They question your motive. They somehow assume the worst about that. You ever felt that before? Jesus knows about that. Jesus has been there. How about we add to that? How about Jesus' relationship with his siblings? Look at me in John 7, please. In John chapter 7, Mary and Joseph did have other children. How'd they get along with their older brother Jesus? Well, in John chapter 7, this is Jesus now as an adult. And we're told here that his earthly ministry is in full swing. People are just amazed at his teaching and the mighty signs and wonders that he was doing. But how did his brothers and sisters feel about him? John 7 gives us an indication. John 7 verse 1, the text says that after this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now the Jews' feast of booths was at hand, so his brothers said to him, and actually that word brothers there is a kind of more neutral term, means brothers and sisters. They said to him, leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works that you're doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. Now you might read that and you might think, wow, they're encouraging their brother. Well, look at the very next verse, verse 5. For not even his brothers believed in him. They did not believe in their brother. And I do believe that statement in verse 5 helps us to understand maybe a little bit about the sarcastic tone, the mocking tone with which they would have said those things in verses 3 and 4. Yeah, Jesus, go over there to Judea. See how that goes for you. People are going to love you over there, bro. You're going to have a great time over there knowing that those are the people who wanted to kill him. They're not encouraging Jesus in his work. Instead, they are ridiculing the work that he's trying to accomplish. You relate to that? You ever felt some of that before in your family? When the people who ought to be your biggest supporters, they don't believe in you. They do not instill confidence in you, but instead they scoff and they belittle and they discourage at every possible turn. Man, I'll tell you, that hurts. That hurts a lot, especially when it comes from the people that you grew up with. People, man, you know, these are my bros and these are my sisters. And no, they're inflicting pain upon me. Jesus knows about that. Let me add another layer to that. Look at Mark 3. In Mark the 3rd chapter, this is Jesus' popularity now is reaching kind of some extraordinary heights. So much so that Mark records this. In Mark chapter 3, this is verse 20. In Mark 3 and in verse 20, then Jesus went home, and the crowd gathered again so that they could not even eat. And when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying, he is out of his mind. Can you maybe even hear some of the siblings saying to Mary, Mom, Jesus is off his rocker. You should hear what people out in the community are saying about him. You know, somebody asked me the other day, why don't y'all do something about him? Put him in a straitjacket or do something with your wacky brother. Come on, he's acting like a crazy person. He's acting like a lunatic. It's just embarrassing. I think this passage indicates that there were times that his own family was embarrassed of Jesus from time to time, ashamed of him from time to time. Think about it. The zeal that Jesus often demonstrated was the kind of zeal that, man, we read and we want to emulate. But for Jesus' family, it was something that made them very, very uncomfortable. It made them uneasy the way Jesus is going around ruffling the feathers of all of the religious elite of the time. The fact that Jesus is just on fire for what he's teaching and what he's saying just made people... Yeah, I just don't know about all of that. Instead of being proud of their brother's courage and their brother's convictions, instead they were mortified. Have you ever had loved ones treat you that way? Maybe be embarrassed to be seen with you out in public? Maybe ashamed to be identified as even being related to you at all? Maybe your fervor and your commitment to Jesus Christ, maybe it's just very off-putting to them. The fact that you're more into this stuff here that we're doing tonight, you're more into this than the things that they're doing out there, man, they just don't get that. They can't even comprehend that. You're almost looked as some kind of religious fanatic. You've been on the receiving end of that kind of thing? The Lord has. Let me put one more layer on top of that. Look with me in Luke 4 now. In Luke chapter 4, this is Jesus now in the city of Nazareth. That's his hometown. This is where he grew up. This is the place where people would have known him. And they would have known his family in a very personal way. Maybe as Jesus walked into town, people would have said, "Hey, look, it's the carpenter's kid. Oh, man, I remember him, he was a little boy helping his dad in the workshop. Him and my kid used to play together and run up and down the street. I remember him." These are the people who you would think would have been the most warm, would have been the most receptive to, you know, kind of their native son coming back home. And so Jesus enters into the synagogue, Luke 4:16 tells us, on the Sabbath day. And he gets up to read from the scriptures. He reads what we know as Isaiah, the 61st chapter. And at the conclusion of that reading, Jesus then closes the book, or closes the scroll, and he says, "You have just seen me fulfill this prophecy," verse 21. And after a little bit of back and forth, a little bit of elaboration on that, notice what the text then tells us, Luke chapter 4, verse 28. "When they heard these things, all in the synagogue were filled with wrath, and they rose up. And they drove him out of the town, and they brought him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built, so that they could throw him down the cliff. But passing through their midst, he went away." What a horrible scene this is. This is really just said so quickly. I mean, we probably don't even fully grasp what an awful thing is happening here. Jesus' neighborhood friends growing up, essentially, are trying to kill him, trying to shove him off a cliff, but... did you notice something that is absent from the text there? There is something that I believe ought to be in the text that's not in the text. Verse 29 ought to say, they brought him to the brow of the hill so that they could throw him down the cliff. But then Jesus' brothers ran in and rescued him and stopped them from doing that. The text doesn't say that, does it? That's what the text ought to say, but it doesn't. And that's because when Jesus was in trouble, his family was not always there for him. They did not always have his back, as we would say. And I think that's obviously due to these first three things. It's because they didn't understand him. It's because they didn't believe in him. It's because they were often ashamed of him. And I ask you once again, has that ever happened to you? You ever been on the receiving end of that sort of treatment? Here you're dealing maybe with something in your life, and you're just sure that even if everybody else, all your friends forsake you, hey, My family's going to be there for me. My family's going to support me. My family's going to help me. They're going to be right there by my side. But then the moment of truth comes, and they're not there. They're nowhere to be found. They didn't show up. They were not there to assist you. And now you are left alone and disappointed and hurt. I'm saying once again, Jesus has felt that pain. As soon as you start swapping stories about awful family experiences, Jesus is going to chime in. He's going to say, "Listen, I understand. I know exactly what you're talking about. I've been there. I had difficult relatives too." Which really just prompts the question that I think we really want to know the answer to, and that is, well, Jesus, what'd you do? How did you deal with that? How did you deal with the often unpleasantness that goes along when all these family members are packed together in the elevator and it is a very, very bumpy ride? How do you handle those difficulties, especially in a wise and God-honoring and God-glorifying way? There's lots of easy fixes on how to deal with family members, but it's not always going to be God-honoring and God-glorifying. How can we do it in a way that God is most glorified? Well, in the remaining time we have tonight, let me set before you just a few ideas right out of the life of Jesus that I think help us in that direction. First and foremost, I believe what we see in Jesus' life is that Jesus dealt with difficult family members because he prepared himself for the possibility that that would have to happen. All that misunderstanding, all of that unbelief, all of that ridicule that Jesus experienced from his own flesh and blood, Jesus wasn't surprised by that. I don't think Jesus was caught off guard by that at all. Jesus knew right up front that there was a chance that some of his family members would not appreciate them. I think he knew that before he ever put on skin and bones and stepped foot on this earth. He readied himself for the very real possibility that his own kinfolk would let him down. And that is precisely why Jesus then tells you and me and all who would be his followers, all who would be his disciples, that you need to prepare yourself for the possibility of that very same thing. Look in Matthew chapter 10, please. In Matthew chapter 10, let's just hear it straight from the source. Here's a passage in Matthew chapter 10 that I'm going to venture a guess is probably not going to be printed on any Christmas cards this year. In Matthew chapter 10, this isn't the quaint family portrait that we would expect people to be promoting, but it's the words of the Lord. In Matthew chapter 10, Jesus says this in verse 34. He says, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I've not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I've come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a person's enemies will be those of his own household." Jesus says that sometimes people will profess their allegiance to me, and then whenever I am brought into that family picture, whenever essentially Jesus then gets brought onto the elevator, not everybody else in the elevator is going to be happy about that. Not everybody else in the elevator is going to warmly embrace that and be so happy about that. In fact, there may be occasions where not only do they not share those same convictions, they may not even at bare minimum respect those convictions. And that's going to create problems, isn't it? And what Jesus says, he says, don't be surprised by that. Continue on, verse 37. Jesus says, "Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Aren't you glad Jesus tells people that up front? I think these are the kinds of passages, actually, when we're studying with somebody who's not a Christian and they're thinking about making the commitment to be a Christian, I think these are essential kinds of passages that we want them to understand before they ever even get into that water. They need to know the commitment that they're making. Jesus lets us know what we're getting into and what we can expect when the going does get tough. I remember a preacher talking a while back about these two sisters who were baptized into Christ. I think they were teenagers, maybe in their early 20s, but they had been invited by a friend at church to come and visit a church, and the friend had been studying with them and talking with them, and ultimately they decided that they wanted to obey the gospel. Well, unfortunately, those two sisters, their parents didn't like that. They didn't like that they were going to be, you know, religious people now. They didn't like the fact that they were going to go down there to that church and cast their lot amongst them. They just didn't care for that at all. And so very, very quickly, those parents started to make life very, very rough for those two daughters. It didn't take long. I think it was just a few weeks that one of the sisters, she just totally renounced her faith. She said, I don't believe. I was just kind of doing what my sister did and just kind of going with the flow. And I'm not in this anymore. I'm done. Which then just left the other. And that other sister remained faithful. She was committed. She really believed what it was that she was doing and what it was that she was all about. And the preacher went to talk to her, to try to console her a little bit, to offer some encouragement. He was being kind of apologetic. "I'm so sorry that you're having to deal with this. I'm so sorry that your sister is doing you this way and your parents have done you this way." She's kind of going on and on and on. After talking for 2 or 3 minutes, eventually the young lady just stopped and she said, just stop, preacher. You don't have to apologize for anything. You don't have to say you're sorry for anything." She then pointed to these verses here in Matthew chapter 10. And she said, "My Lord said that if my family members don't accept Him, then in essence, they don't accept me, and that makes them not worthy." And as harsh as that may sound in the ears of some, that is exactly right. Oftentimes, family happens to be the last place that you're going to be able to get the support that you need to do what is right. Look at Mark, the 6th chapter, please. Jesus builds on that in Mark 6. He comes to his hometown. And once again, Mark 6, Jesus does not get the hero's welcome. Look at what he says. Look at the reception that he gets in Mark chapter 6 and in verse 3. Mark 6 and in verse 3, they said, "Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary and the brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us?" I mean, he's just so ordinary. And they took offense at him. Verse 4. And Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his relatives and in his own household." Jesus just says, sometimes family doesn't give you what you need. They will let you down. And guess what? He says, don't be surprised by that. Jesus tells us that we need to come to grips with the reality so that we will then be prepared to deal with that if and when it comes. Maybe one of the most important ways that Jesus dealt with that and dealt with difficult relatives was the second idea, and that is that Jesus never attempted to force them to change. Jesus knew, not just in dealing with his family, but Jesus knew in dealing with all people, that you can't somehow twist people's arms. You can't force people, you can't push people to make changes that they don't want to make. And so Jesus never attempted to do such a thing. Would you go back to Matthew 10 again? In Matthew the 10th chapter, as Jesus is about to send out the 12 to begin doing some teaching and doing some mighty works, he gives them these important instructions in Matthew 10 and in verse 12. Jesus says there, Matthew 10 and in verse 12, he says that if the house is worthy, so you go to different houses, if the house is worthy, then let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. And if anyone will not receive you or listen to your words, you shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that house or that town. Truly I say to you, it'll be more bearable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town. Jesus says, hey, if people don't want the gospel, if people are not interested in the gospel, then don't go shoving that on them. Don't go trying to cram that down their throats. Instead, you shake off the dust, kind of a symbolic gesture to let them know that, hey, I've done my part. You know that a prophet has been here, and then you leave. Don't stay there and coerce or manipulate or try to somehow force people to accept it. If they don't want it, they don't want it. And it's not going to do any good for you to try to force and ramrod a change in them. Have you ever given any thought to the fact that if Jesus could not force his family to share his convictions and do what was right, what makes us think that we would be able to do that with our family members who do not believe? Do you really think you're going to be able to do something that Jesus wasn't able to do? Make no mistake about it. As Christians, we are put here upon this earth to influence, to teach, to share, to invite, to lead. But listen to me, we are not here to push. And sometimes I fear that our desire to help bring about a change in our loved one's circumstances, sometimes that desire within us, it is so strong that we end up speaking when we should have been silent. We end up being harsh when we should have been gentle. We end up being pushy when we should have been setting a quiet example. In fact, isn't that what the Apostle Peter would say over in 1 Peter chapter 3 about the believing wife affecting a change in her unbelieving husband? That's not accomplished by force, Peter says. It's not accomplished by nagging or berating or guilt trips. No, it is the result of respectful and pure conduct. It is the result of a gentle and quiet spirit, 1 Peter 3 verses 1 through 4. Sometimes what we need to do, and this is sometimes the hardest thing, sometimes with our family members, what is best is we just need to back off. Sometimes we just need to realize, you know what? Maybe I'm just not the one. Maybe it's going to need to be somebody else. I'm too close to the situation. Somebody else is going to have to be the influencer here. I need to back off, quit trying to fix everybody, and I'll just pray. I'll let my light shine, and I'll just pray that they will sometime, in due time, be changed by the love and the grace of God. But you know what? For as much as Jesus didn't try to force a change in his family members, I should say as well, Jesus, put all of them on the screen at once. This is like when you go, you think about when you're a kid, you get the boxes of cereal, and it's got the toy, and the toy is supposed to be at the bottom, and the excitement is like digging down to get to it, but then you open it up, and it's like, it's right there on top, gives it all away. Well, giving up. Don't look down here. Let's just look right here at the third one right now. And that is that Jesus did not allow his family members to change him. Now, I want to be careful here with this one. I do not want to ever suggest that we want to be so close-minded that we would never be ready to accept fault, to receive the legitimate criticism of others, especially if someone's pointing out a matter of sin in our lives. I'm not saying that we should never admit guilt in our own shortcomings and weaknesses. We need to be ready to do that. But that's not what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about here is that when you're doing right, And as you examine yourself, as we talked about Sunday morning, you examine yourself, and as best you can tell, you are blameless. If you are doing right, and you are right where God wants you to be, I'm saying, don't move. Don't move. Do not compromise. Do not let your love or your affection for a family member move you away from doing what is right in the sight of God. Jesus never did that. And I am sure that there probably was part of Jesus in his emotions that he wanted so badly for his family to accept him, to receive him, and to believe in him. But he never allowed them to change him from his purpose and what he was here for. Jesus kept doing the will of the Father despite his family's unbelief. Look with me in Luke 14. In Luke, the 14th chapter, Jesus makes it clear that he has an expectation for all of those who would be followers of his that we would demonstrate that exact same commitment, that exact same devotion. In Luke 14, he says this in verse 26. In these great discipleship sayings, he says in Luke 14, 26, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Sometimes people have trouble with that verse. They read that stuff about hate. I'm supposed to hate my mom and dad? Really? Is that what's going on? Well, no. Not in the sense that we understand that word or the way that we use the word hate today. The word here is the idea of loving less. That the love that we have for father, mother, brother, sister, son, or daughter, that it is less than the love that we have for the Lord. In fact, if you could somehow put those loves on a spectrum somewhere, it would look like this, that the love that we have for Jesus is so great that in comparison to the love that we have for our family, the difference in those two loves is so wide that yes, it would be like the difference between love and hate. There's just that great of a chasm between those two kinds of love. And so Jesus says here that your love for me, he says it must be an unrivaled love, that nothing else can even come close to that. And so as much as I love my wife, and I do, it cannot compare to the love that I have for my Lord. As much as I love my two little girls, and it's hard for me to imagine having a love greater than that. But yes, the love that I have for Jesus is greater. My commitment to Him must be undeterred and unswayed by any earthly relationship. That is the depth of commitment that the Lord is calling us to. That I would just be so steadfast in my service to Him that no parent, no child, no sibling, no anybody could ever interfere in my relationship with Jesus the Christ. And maybe closely connected with that would be this fourth idea. And that is that Jesus dealt with difficult family in that he did not make it his mission on earth to please them. Let me just say very candidly here. If your mission, if kind of the way you live your life, if your MO in life is all about pleasing people and making people happy, then you're always going to be a slave to the thoughts and the opinions of other people. When I first started doing some preaching years ago, I'll just confess, I was very much a slave to everybody else's opinion about my preaching ability. I would always, way too much. It probably is to some degree, it's healthy for a preacher to care what people think about him. But in the early goings, man, I was obsessed with what other people thought about my preaching. If somebody said that my preaching wasn't as good as Brother So-and-so, I went home and tried to figure out how I could be like Brother So-and-so. If somebody said, "You're preaching, you need to do more of this," I went home and tried to figure out how to do more of that. If somebody said, "Hey, in your preaching, you need to do less of this," well, I went home and tried to figure out how to do less of that. Finally, I got to realize, it took several years to finally realize, there's no way I can please all of those different taskmasters. What I needed to focus on was pleasing the Master, the one and the only Master, the Lord, and then let all those other things fall in line after that. And I'm saying to you this evening that that's what Jesus did in all of his dealings with human beings. Look in John 8. In John the 8th chapter, as Jesus is addressing this audience that has assembled here at the temple, he says this in John 8 and in verse 29. He says that he who sent me is with me, He has not left me alone. For I always do the things that are pleasing to Him. And that is what it's all about, isn't it? We're trying to please Him. Paul would say it in 2 Corinthians 5 and in verse 9, that whether we are at home or whether we are away, we make it our aim to please Him. In fact, step out of the Gospels for a moment. Look in Galatians 1. In Galatians 1, Paul actually says here that when you try to be a people pleaser, when it's all about trying to make other people happy and placating them, Paul says you're going to run into a really big problem. In Galatians chapter 1, he says this in verse 10. He says, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Do you see? When you're all consumed with trying to make people happy, Paul says, you can't even be a Christian. You can't even be who you're supposed to be as a servant of Jesus Christ. Your service to the Lord is going to be stifled and hindered. And so I'm going to say, I understand our desire. If you're a child, I understand the desire to please mom and dad. And sometimes as you get older, sometimes the roles kind of get reversed there. Sometimes parents really want to get the approval of their children. Sometimes it's in a spouse situation. One spouse wants to receive the approval of another spouse. They want them to be happy with them, and they want things to be peaceful and joyous and great all the time. But if your life is all about trying to gain the approval of other people, earthly family members included, you need to understand that in the grand scheme of things, what they think, how they feel, it is irrelevant. This is about pleasing the Lord. Which would lead me then to that fifth observation from the life of Jesus. And that is that even when Jesus' family members treated him unwell, Jesus never, ever retaliated at their mistreatment. I need to step out of the Gospels again. Look in 1 Peter chapter 2 now. In 1 Peter chapter 2, here's a passage that we often read, and when we do, we think about the abuse that was heaped upon Jesus from his enemies. We think about the Sanhedrin Council and the Pharisees and those groups of people, the crucifiers. But don't forget that some of Jesus' own family members could actually fit some of the descriptions of what's described here. In 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter says this in verse 21. In 1 Peter 2 and in verse 21, he says, "For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in His steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in His mouth. When He was reviled, He did not revile in return. And when He suffered, He did not threaten, but He continued entrusting Himself to Him who judges justly." Jesus did not ever retaliate. Jesus did not ever trade jabs. And think about it. Have you ever considered that if anybody could have ever said the exact right words, I mean the kind of words that would just put somebody in their place, would just cause their face to just melt right there on the spot. If somebody could say words with laser-focused precision that would just bring a person down to their knees, Jesus would have been that person. And in many ways, we think He had been justified in doing just that. But He didn't. He didn't. And maybe what the example of Jesus shows us here, as 1 Peter 2 indicates, is that sometimes what we need to be willing to do, even in our own families, is we just need to be willing to take it on the chin sometimes. Just take one for the team. Just grit and bear it. And I know sometimes we feel very justified. Family members say stuff to us. Maybe they ridicule us for our faith and make fun of us and whatever. And we feel justified to just lash right back at them and shout at them and give them what for. And well, we're going to find out who's going to be right come the day of judgment. And we just start blasting them, and we even justify it in our minds with, well, if you can't fuss with your family, well, who can you fuss with? And all sorts of silly little cliches like that. I understand the temptation there. But what did Peter say in 1 Peter 2 verse 21? Peter says, "We have been called to look at the example of Jesus so that you might follow in His steps." You bite your tongue. You count to 10. You say a prayer. Whatever it takes, Jesus endured the mistreatment of family and others, and He just entrusted Himself to the Lord that He would do justly. you and I must develop the same attitude of trust in the Lord that He's going to do what's right. Which then leads me, surprise, surprise, to this final point this evening. And in many ways, everything that I've said in this lesson has been building up to this one point. But it was essential to get to this one point. In fact, if you don't remember anything else out of this lesson tonight, number one, you probably should have paid better attention. But number two, if you only remember one thing, I need you to remember this last thing. And that is that Jesus was able to deal with difficult family members. Because at the end of the day, He knew who true family was. Go back to Mark, the third chapter. Mark chapter 3. We'll bring this to a climax here. In Mark 3, you remember when the family members, they came seeking for Jesus, and they were saying He's out of His mind, and we just want to, you know, get Him and take Him home, bless His heart, He just doesn't know what He's doing. Well, that story actually resumes at the end of that chapter in Mark 3. Look at verse 31. In Mark 3, verse 31, then His mother and His brothers came. And standing outside, they sent to Him and they called Him. And then a crowd was sitting around Him and they said to Him, Your mother and Your brothers, they're outside seeking You. And He answered them, Who are My mother and My brothers? And looking about at those who sat around Him, He said, Here are My mother and My brothers. For whoever does the will of God, he is My brother and My sister and My mother. What is true family? Is it the folks that we take the elevator ride with? No. I'm not on there long enough for them to know me or me to really even get to know them or even begin to feel like family with them. What is true family? Is it those people that we share the same last name and maybe even have some DNA and traits and other things that we have in common with one another, the people that we're here on earth with in that respect? Well, not necessarily. According to Jesus here in Mark chapter 3, true family are those who do God's will. It is the people that I will spend eternity with. That's who real family is. Now, I want you to understand, I am not in any way, by saying that, I am not trying to diminish the significance and the importance of our earthly families. There is value to our earthly families. God is very pro-family. You can read it from the beginning of the Bible all the way to the end. God has all kinds of stuff in there about the family. God is pro-family. He is for the family. But have any of you ever seen or heard about the rope illustration? This is not original with me. There's a popular evangelical preacher who I saw illustrated this once, and it's just always stuck with me. He took a rope. And imagine that this rope that I have, obviously you can see that it has an end, but imagine that this rope represents eternity. And imagine this rope just goes on and on and on and on, and it never ever ends. But you may be able to see, I've torn off a little piece here at the top of the rope. Imagine that this little white part here, this represents your time here upon this earth. Actually, I put a black dot here. Imagine that black dot. That represents your time here in this physical body here upon planet Earth. And of course, that's a different amount of time for all of us. Maybe you get to live to a good ripe old age of 70 or 80 or maybe 90 or 100 years old. Whatever that amount of time is, that's what represents your time here upon this Earth. Can I ask you, are any of us, when we get to heaven, and when we have been there for 1,000 years, or when we've been there for 10,000 years, are any of us going to look back at that one little dot all the way back there, way, 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 way back, it's even smaller now than it was long ago, are any of us going to look back at that one little black dot and say, oh man, I remember my time there on earth, and man, that little black spot represented all the great things we did on earth? And right there, that one little flick of dust that's on top of that black spot, that represented my family. And that's who my family was. Is that what we'll be saying in heaven? I'm going to submit to you that that is not the song we'll be singing in heaven. Because true family are the people you're going to be spending all of this time with. That's who your family is. And I want my daddy to be in that family. I want my mama to be in that family. And by the grace of God, at this present time, they are in that family. I want my brothers Luke and Aaron and Ben to be in that family. I want my wife Tiffany to be in that family. And they are all in the family. I want one day for my girls, for Hattie and for Gertie, for them to obey the gospel and them to be a part of this family. I want all of my earthly loved ones to be in this true family. But listen to me carefully. If they don't serve Jesus, if they do not love Him with all their heart and mind and soul and strength and give Him the service of their lives, then they are not my family. And I know there may be people here tonight, they're going to leave here upset that I said that. That may sound very, very harsh. But I'm just going to echo what Jesus says in Mark the 3rd chapter, that true family are the ones who do the will of God. It's the people we will spend eternity with. And I'll just tell you, when you've been with the people of God forever and ever and ever and ever, you're just not going to look back at that one little speck of time and think so glowingly and fondly about that, about people who didn't care about God, who had no respect for His Word, for people who did not love His Son and say, oh, that was my family. No, they're not. No, they're not. That's why Jesus says we need to get a lock right now on who true family is. And then once we know who that family is, we need to lean in to that family. Be fully on board with that family. And I'll tell you, it's been my observation that people who grew up with rotten upbringings, people who had moms and dads that just weren't worth a count, people who had brothers and sisters who were ungodly, they came from a family that didn't care about the Lord and weren't interested in that at all, but then they learn the truth and they become a Christian, I found that it is those people, they understand what true family is. They, in many ways, they understand it better than the rest of us do, those of us that kind of, you know, grew up on the pew. I remember a couple of years ago, I sat in a worship assembly, and I observed a young man that as the Lord's Supper was being observed, he just was just pouring tears. Just tears just flowing down his face. And I went up to him after services. I was concerned. I thought, I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what was going on through his mind. And I asked him, I said, brother, are you okay? What's going on? Just want to make sure everything was all right. And he wiped all the tears away and cleared his eyes up, put a smile on his face. He said, I'm all right. I'm more than all right. He said, just as we were thinking about the Lord and His sacrifice and what He's done for us, what He did for me, I got to thinking about all that the Lord has done for me specifically. He then elaborated and he said, when I was growing up, I didn't have a family to speak of. He said, my mom was a drug addict. And my dad was in jail. And I just kind of floated from here to there with this person and that person, an aunt over here, a random individual over there. But then I grew up. And some good people helped me to find the truth. And I submitted my life to Jesus. And in that moment, the Lord gave me a family. And he was just overwhelmed as he talked about that. He said, I now have a father. A father who loves me. And a father who cares for me. A father who provides for me and sustains me by His Word. I now have an older brother. I never had an older brother growing up. Now I do have an older brother. Jesus, who saves me, who gives Himself for me, who strengthens me and He mediates on my behalf. On top of that, I've got all kinds of other brothers and sisters now. People who encourage me, people who admonish me, people who love me and help me to get to heaven. I now have a family. And I'm saying to you tonight, Christian, that when your earthly family fails you, when they hurt you, when they leave you alone and they let you down, I want you to remember the words of the Lord here in Mark chapter 3. And that is that here is my brother. Here is my sister. Here is my mother. It is those who do the will of God. That is true family. One final verse, and the lesson will be yours. I'm going to put it on the screen for you. In Acts, the first chapter. In Acts chapter 1, when the disciples were waiting in Jerusalem, just as Jesus had told them to do when he was going to ascend back into heaven, we're told this little nugget. It's almost just said in passing, but it catches my eye every time that I think about this. In Acts chapter 1, and in verse 14, we're told that these all continued with one accord in prayer and supplication with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. Do you see it there? Do you see that the ones who once misunderstood him, the ones who once disbelieved in him, the ones who once gave him a hard time and were ashamed of him, Jesus' difficult family members, they eventually got on board. In fact, they became pillars in the early days of the church. That the ones who once pitied him, they now praise him. And the ones who once mocked him, they now serve him. And I got to tell you, I think that much of that change had to do with the way that Jesus very patiently and carefully dealt with them, the way that he worked with them, the way that he just continued to set the right example. As one writer put it, Jesus gave them space, and God gave them grace. Jesus helps us, doesn't he? He helps us even with our families. What do you think about God's family? You've listened very well tonight. I've spoke a long time, been very emotional, but you've listened well. What do you think about God's family? I'm not going to stand up here and lie to you and tell you that God's family is absolutely perfect. It's not. Our father's perfect. Our older brother is perfect. But down here, at least on this side of eternity, we're not perfect. We don't profess to be. But we're asking, are you interested in maybe taking an elevator ride with us? Because we're trying to go from here to heaven to be with our father and to be with our older brother and to be with all of our brothers and sisters of all time throughout the ages. If you have never surrendered and submitted to Jesus the Christ in the waters of baptism, tonight would be a great night to do that. If we need to talk about that and study about that, we can do that. If you're ready to take action, to step out in faith, to become a child of God this evening, we can help you with that. It would just be a privilege for us to help you in having your sins washed away, being forgiven. And just maybe one of the great blessings about all that is the Lord then adds you. He adopts you into His family. If you are in the family, you are a part of the family of God, but brother or sister, maybe you've not been living as you ought to. Maybe somewhere along the way, that commitment, that devotion that Jesus calls for, maybe it has wavered. Maybe you've got a weak spot. If that is the case with you, we're encouraging you to repent. Let us pray with you. Let us help you, just as a family should and would do, so that we can all get to heaven and be with the family forever and ever. If you're subject to heaven's invitation in any way, we're inviting you and encouraging you through the words of this song. Do something about it right now while we stand and while we sing.